Wake up to the One Love Breakfast every weekday morning from 7 a.m. keeping Bristol together. Come and join the thousands of people who care about our city and the diverse communities.
We're leaving a terrible legacy of poisoning and diminishment of the environment for our grandchildren's grandchildren, generations not yet born. Some people have called that intergenerational tyranny, a form of taxation levied by us on generations yet to be.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Dave Roxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As ISIS faces defeat in Syria, a new war begins, a propaganda war. Who's really blowing up hospitals and schools now? And news about the November Paris attacks this week has snuck through. Without really hitting the headlines, it looks like the main suspect, the French police have said did it, didn't do it at all. And whatever happened to Richard Tomlinson, the MI6 spy who released a sworn statement that he saw a British Secret Service plan to murder Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic? It was orchestrated using a high-speed car crash in a tunnel, using the exact same method with a flash to disorientate the driver used to murder Princess Diana in 1997. Tonight we take a look at two senior MI6 figures and how their apparent involvement in the 1997 assassination of Diana led to knighthoods and their meteoric rise to power, both joining yet notorious US war criminal Henry Kissinger at the secretive Bilderberg Group. Bilderberg was founded in 1954 by a former SS officer, along with his British and American collaborators, and nowadays it plays an important role, choosing the Secretary Generals of NATO, and more worryingly, even selecting many of the top politicians in the NATO countries. And staying with Kissinger, the Prince of Darkness, Bernie Sanders makes Kissinger the clear dividing line between himself and the other hopeful for the Democratic nomination in the United States, Hillary Clinton. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspot. But I think we'll start with Syria, Martin. It seems that we've been getting quite a lot of reports of Russians, at least in this country, those reports, attacking hospitals. Beginning of the week, the weekend, we had, I think it was first of all two hospitals attacked, then three hospitals, then four hospitals and two schools, all being attacked by Russian bombers.
Well, the Russians have already given a press conference about this. They've got a deal with the Americans and the British, I presume, where they don't bomb at the same time in the same place. And I'm afraid that hospitals that were hit in Aleppo were hit on one of the NATO days, not one of the Russian days. And the Russians are quite clear, we were bombing 20 kilometres away. I suspect that this could be quite a deliberate attack on hospitals by the Turkish military, who are then going to say, the Russians did this, we need to invade to save people in Syria. Because an awful lot of things are going on. You haven't mentioned the fact that the Turkish army has been firing over the border into Syria at the Kurdish rebels, who are just about to retake Azaz, which is another major town on the road to Aleppo and Turkey.
Well, why would the Turks want to stop the Kurds beating ISIS there?
Because they support ISIS, and I've seen a photograph on the internet this week of an ISIS camp with these guys waving their Kalashnikovs, and they're waving both an ISIS flag and a Turkish flag, because in actual fact, ISIS is Turkey. As the head of the PKK's military wing gave a press conference this week in Moscow, and he said, well, our evidence is that Turks are backing ISIS, and that they regard us as the enemy. What will happen, you see, if the Kurds, PKK-aligned guerrillas in Syria are successful, and they're getting air support from the Russians, they will be able to seal the whole border, create an autonomous Kurdish zone, which then means that Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra and ISIS rebels further deeper into Syria will be cut, their supply lines will be cut. Although yesterday 500 new rebels passed across the Syrian border into Syria from Turkey, heading for Azaz to prevent the Kurds from taking it.
So the Turkish reinforcements of ISIS?
They are non-Syrian jihadi terrorists who are being infiltrated directly into Syria to resist the Kurds, who are actually Syrians. The Kurds live in Syria. And it's all becoming very clear what's going on here. Both Saudi Arabia and Turkey are talking up the idea that they are going to intervene in Syria. The Russians and the Syrian government made it absolutely clear that they won't accept that. That as things stand, they've got a deal with Britain, the US, etc., that they won't bomb at the same time. Now, in actual fact, the bombing, the day of the attacks on these hospitals, you say, well, they wouldn't kill innocent people in order just to make the Syrians and the Russians look bad, would they? Well, don't forget, there's another bomb in Ankara this week, which killed 28 people at the military headquarters in the centre of Ankara. Many people, the PKK haven't claimed it, ISIS haven't claimed it, nobody's claimed it, but everybody in Turkey, whatever their politics, knows about Ergonekon, the Ergonekon networks embedded within the security structure in Turkey, which carried out all kinds of attacks, assassinations, bombings throughout the 70s and the 80s, all run by NATO intelligence.
This is a long running,
and everybody knows about
this. This is a long running court case where all sorts of people, including army officers, judges, people right across the power spectrum in Turkey, were actually imprisoned for attacking Turkey itself and blaming it on who?
On various groups.
Or mostly the Kurds.
Yeah, well, they were basically setting up Islamist terrorists, right-wing terrorists, left-wing terrorists. The Grey Wolves were sort of right-wing secular terrorists. But everybody in Turkey knows that this is how it works. And Turkey, of course, is an integral part of NATO. At the minute, there are two police officers and two journalists on trial in Turkey for treason, because the police officers had stopped a humanitarian, so-called humanitarian convoy crossing the border into Syria. When they searched it was packed with weapons for ISIS and Al-Nusra Front, and they impounded them. They, instead of being given a pat on the back, were prosecuted. They then tipped off the journalists. The journalists then did what we're doing and talked about it. Now, both the journalists and the police officers are being put on trial by the Erdogan government as traitors. Nevertheless, what they uncovered was that MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, was definitely supplying weaponry directly to jihadi terrorists inside Syria. And I mentioned to people listening to this show, Turkey is an integral part of the NATO intelligence structure. British officers will know exactly what they were doing, because British and US officers have been working very closely with MIT on that border to supply ISIS with weaponry. Meanwhile, of course, telling everybody in the community at large in their own countries that we're there to stop ISIS. Nobody on the ground in Syria believes that for a minute. And we are definitely implicated in supplying, arming and training jihadi terrorists in Syria, and not just in Syria. Now, what should be done if we find senior people in our intelligence operation who have been involved in that? What should we do to those people?
Well, Martin, we're also very, very close to Saudi Arabia. Prince Charles is
indeed
very, very close to Saudi Arabia, Britain's diplomatic service, etc., supplying the Saudis with British jets. I mean, Margaret Thatcher's son, in fact.
Yeah, the Al-Yamamar defence deal, which made a cool £12 million for Mark Thatcher, the son of the then Prime Minister.
And now also with munitions to bomb Yemen with, which is strategically, why are the Saudis, who are of course also massively involved in Syria in supporting ISIS, what about Yemen? Why the Yemen? Because this seems as the Saudis are a very powerful country, extremely rich, oil wealthy country. Yemen is one of the most ancient civilizations on the planet, and I just do not understand why Yemen is a target of the Saudis. Right. It's only going to be bad for them. Attacking 8,000 civilian casualties there now. This has been running for nearly a year.
Well, it's a tragedy for the people of Yemen, obviously, but of course the Saudis aren't winning. They're losing. And of course, what you've got to remember that Saudi Arabia isn't a real state. It's just like a family business, which was set up by the British in the 1920s and then taken over by the Americans in the 40s. And in actual fact, what could happen if we're going to start redrawing boundaries is that you just get rid of Saudi Arabia altogether. And all the oil in Saudi Arabia, for example, you might say that it ought to go to raise the living standards of the millions of people in Yemen. That's Yemeni oil, not Saudi oil. It's only Saudi oil because we support the Saudi royal family who say that that oil belongs to us. In actual fact, that's just oil in Arabia in general, which could easily be used to increase the standard of living in Yemen, where the population of Yemen, that's where the most of the population in Arabia lives. That's where they've always lived. They don't live in the desert where the Saudi sheikhs come from. They were just a few nomads who happened to, their camels just happened to range around on top of an oil field. Although another twist in all of this is that most of the oil in Saudi Arabia is actually under the East Rumaila oil field on the east of Saudi Arabia, which is actually just opposite Bahrain, and most of the people who live in that region are Shia, who are absolutely hostile, fundamentally hostile to the Saudi government. And if you could say, well, they should have the oil, most of the oil workers in Saudi Arabia are Shia, not Saudi Sunni sheikhs. So the whole regime is an absolute. It's one of the most repressive regimes in the world. They've got something like 30,000 political prisoners admitted. And they haven't got a huge population.
So why are the elite in this country, the government here, and the most powerful businesses, politicians, royalty, supporting Saudi Arabia?
Because they're all because it suits their book to do so. Meanwhile, we're trying to push out the secular elected government of Syria because they're not democratic enough, and that's why we've got to go and blow up their hospitals and shoot their children. It's absolutely disgusting. And as we've pointed out on this show before, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has been on French television 3 years ago, saying, before the Arab Spring, before the war in Syria started, I was approached by British officials, we're probably talking about MI6 here, saying, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? So we've got prima facie evidence that the whole war in Syria may have been begun by our own security services, who have intimate links with the jihadi terrorists.
No, you've got the former French foreign minister's hearsay, not prima facie.
No. That is a beginning of an that is absolutely factual stuff and to the point. He might be lying, but then you've got to come up with a reason. Why would he be lying about something like that? In any case, the evidence is overwhelming that British and US special forces and intelligence services have been working with the Turks and the Saudis to try and overthrow Assad. They've definitely been doing it. They've been doing it for 4 years. They just haven't succeeded. And now, of course, they're getting into a more and more of a mess because they're not going to succeed without World War III.
Okay.
And have they got the bottle for that? We're going to find out, aren't we?
A couple of weeks ago, there's quite a big conference about trying to get a ceasefire organised for Syria. So let's go back to Prime Minister's questions last week, and here, because there was a question came up about that precise topic.
Mitchell! Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, deserves great credit for the results of the Syria replenishment conference, which was held under his co-authorship in London. But he will be aware that this can only address the symptoms of the catastrophe that is Syria today, and not the causes. Can he tell the House what more he thinks the British government can do to try and promote the political track and ensure that it reaches the most speedy possible success?
Well, first of all, can I thank my right honourable friend for what he says about the Syria conference, and it gives me the opportunity to thank my co-hosts, the Norwegians, the Germans, the Kuwaitis, and the Secretary-General of the United Nations. We raised in one day more money than has ever been raised at one of these conferences ever in history, over $10 billion. And I want to pay tribute to my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for DFID, who did a lot of the very hard work that was done. Now, this money helps because it will keep people in the region, it will feed people, clothe people, make sure they get the medicine that they need, but we do need this political solution. We go on working with all of our partners to deliver this, but it does require all countries, including Russia, to recognise the need for a moderate Sunni opposition to be at the table to create a transitional authority in Syria. Without that, I fear we'll end up with a situation where you have Assad in one corner and Daesh in the other corner, the worst possible outcome in terms of terrorism, the worst possible outcome in terms of refugees, and the worst possible outcome for the future of Syria.
Well, isn't it interesting? He said moderate Sunni opposition. What he means by that is not Daesh, he means Al-Qaeda. He means the Al-Nusra Front. That's what he means. He wants them to be at the table, but he doesn't want, he agrees with the Turks, that the Kurds, who are actually secular leftists, they're not to be at the table because it would upset the Turks. But Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda Syria, we've just been fighting a war on terror for 15 years against Al-Qaeda, but they have got to come to the negotiating table in Syria. And the answer from the Syrian government and the Russians is, we're not negotiating with Al-Qaeda. And we are actually supporting Al-Qaeda, as we did in Libya, as we did in Afghanistan in the 1980s. At the same time as going on... Al-Qaeda are moderates now. Petraeus, who was in charge in Iraq, he's openly said it. Well, we should be supporting Al-Qaeda because they're better than Daesh. But everybody knows, the Iranians know, the Russian general staff knows, that in actual fact Daesh, ISIS, is basically funded, armed, trained and directed by the Gulf Cooperation countries led by Saudi Arabia and NATO, led by Turkey, Britain and the United States, with the Israelis chucking their tuppence halfpenny in. Everybody knows that. So this mealy-mouthed, we've raised loads and loads of money to help the people of Syria. The thing you can do to help the people of Syria, Prime Minister, is to get to the bottom of who, within our own security structure, are the terrorists. That's what they've got to do in Turkey. That's what they've got to do here. And we will name names and we will find out which of our intelligence services have been arming and training these terrorists, and we will make the full force of the law applicable. That's the way to defeat terrorism. And it's actually easier than crawling around on the ground in Syria, because the people we need to arrest live right here in the United States.
I mean, surely the force of the law doesn't really apply here. For a start, it's abroad, and also these people have all sorts of protection, immunity. They're doing covert operations, that kind of thing.
Well, indeed, but those covert operations are illegal. And I would put it to any police officer listening to what we're saying here, it is your duty to arrest intelligence operatives who are engaged in terrorist activity. And that's it. We're not joking about this. We're deadly serious. Because if you don't arrest intelligence operatives who are engaged in terrorist activity, then others will take the law into their own hands.
I mean, we had this in Watergate, didn't we, where the intelligence services started to turn their attention to domestic politics and start interfering in domestic political affairs, raiding, in that case,
they always have.
The Democratic Party headquarters.
Yeah, but that was a tip of an iceberg, if you like. That's what they were pulled up on, and Nixon eventually fell because he'd tried to cover it up. But in actual fact, of course, the COINTELPRO operations run by FBI involved murder, assassination, blackmail, all sorts of things. And we talked about paedophile scandals on here. It involved things like that. That's what they get up to. And I expect independent civilian police forces, whether it's here or in Colombia or anywhere else, to arrest intelligence operatives who are involved in that. And we've got an example of that happening in this country. Sir John Stevens, who was the head of the Metropolitan Police, looked into the workings of the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr, and he went to Jackson, who was head of the army, and said, "I'm afraid your brigadier is going to have to stand trial as a terrorist." He never did. But it was a 14-year investigation by the police, and the finger was firmly pointed. You are terrorists. They are. They are. They are. It needs to be repeated and repeated until people get it through their heads. Our own intelligence services are the major sponsors of Islamist terrorism. It's always been true. It's still true.
Going to the present day, this ceasefire that David Cameron was talking about in the clip from Prime Minister's Questions is supposed to be starting just about now. Looking at the Washington Post, they're saying US says meeting for Syria ceasefire has been delayed, not cancelled, as the Russians claim. But that is coming from the Washington Post, of course. This is Hugh Naylor and Michael Birnbaum in Beirut, saying Russia and the United States appeared at odds today about whether a meeting of the International Court coordinating group charged with implementing a Syria ceasefire had been cancelled, with Russia's foreign ministry claiming it was, the US and UN officials saying it was merely delayed. Back and forth Friday adds to delays in reducing hostilities and raises even more questions about the workability of the truce. I wonder what you make of the workability, Martin.
Well, I think what's happening here is that the Russians and the Syrians are doing what the North Vietnamese used to do, which is called fight and talk. They're open to discussions with anybody, but they're not just going to give up doing what they're doing. They're basically winning. The reason why the West suddenly wants a political solution is because their protégés on the ground are getting crushed. So suddenly they want a ceasefire. Previously, of course, they just wanted Assad overthrown by the moderate Sunni rebels that he keeps talking about. As you can understand, if you're a Christian or a Shia or an Alawite in Syria, the idea of these moderate Sunni rebels taking over is completely unacceptable. I mean, the heads of the Christian church in Syria have visited Britain and been to the House of Lords and said, why are you supporting people who are killing us? And those are the moderate rebels that... that our Prime Minister thinks should be at the negotiating table.
Discussions in London led to a statement last Friday, this time a week ago, saying that there will be a cessation of hostilities within a week.
We will see what happens, because don't forget the Turks are still shelling the Kurds and also attacking Syrian army positions in the north of the country.
Also, Martin, this week we've had US warplanes hitting militants in Libya, 40 people dead there too.
Well, indeed, and of course another intervention in Libya is just about to happen. If we do intervene in Libya, by the way, as the SNP said about our intervention, we've intervened in Yemen as well, of course. The British military personnel are on the ground in Saudi Arabia helping the Saudis to kill civilians in Yemen. Are those people war criminals? If they were working for the Syrian army, they'd be accused of being war criminals. Just because they're in the British army and they're killing civilians with the Saudis, are they war criminals or not? Maybe they're not war criminals. Maybe they're just soldiers. And as soldiers, they should be killed, because that's what soldiers are for.
And on antiwar.com, the Syrian Kurds, Martin, are denying claims that they were to blame for this week's bombing in Ankara.
Well, of course they were going to say that. But isn't it interesting that Erdogan, as soon as it happened, he said, oh, we know who's done this, it's the Syrian Kurds. And it just so happens that we're just shelling the Syrian Kurds. Do you know what the Kurds in Syria and in Turkey think about this? They think that Erdogan did it. In order to make them look bad. And of course they also bombed the rally, which 100 people died at, that Kurdish peace rally. That was bombed supposedly by ISIS. Everybody, every Kurdish person and every moderate middle of the road person in Turkey knows who did that. That was MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, who worked very, very closely with CIA, MI6 and the Saudis. It's the scales are coming off people's eyes in the Middle East. People are beginning to realise, they've known for years, it's really obvious what's going on. The super radical jihadi Sunni terrorists are mostly supported by Saudi Arabia with the help of NATO. That's the reality. And in actual fact, the Syrian Arab Army, which has taken 60,000 casualties fighting these people, is winning. Hooray for them. I'm not a pacifist. I want to see the defeat of jihadi terrorism. And that includes probably the arrest and imprisonment of top intelligence officials of NATO. That's the only way. That's the only way forward.
I mean, of course, this is all a long way away during the time of the Iraq War. The horrors that were going on and still go on in places like Baghdad, where bombs go off weekly, people don't know who's planted them, that kind of thing. That
indeed.
Utter chaos. But of course, that back in November came to the streets of Paris, just across the channel. And we heard this week there's a mystery as the DNA of Europe's top terror suspect turns out it's not on the discarded suicide vest, which was his, that the French police and French secret services, basically a whole part of what they thought had happened at those Paris terror attacks seems to be crumbled completely here, Martin.
Well, listen, what are we being...
It doesn't look like it was his vest at all.
What are we being told here? The authorities find a discarded suicide belt. Now, it may be that they genuinely found a discarded suicide belt, or it may be that they just planted one. I only plant this thought in your minds because we know that NATO intelligence services behave like this in Turkey, in Italy and elsewhere. So it's quite, well, I don't necessarily believe them when they say they found it. And in any case, somebody could have planted it, just like somebody planted the Syrian passport, which was on one of the suicide bombers. He just dropped his passport, and just like the Coarchi brothers who supposedly carried out
into the detail here a little bit, because the French police are saying that actually they may know it was his suicide belt because they traced his mobile phone signal on the night of the attacks.
That's what they say. Now, the point is that the his DNA is not on the suicide belt. Now, you wouldn't expect it to be on a suicide belt which had been planted, would you? Now, I don't necessarily trust what these people are telling us. Given what we know about how they operate, you cannot believe that they're necessarily telling the truth. Nobody in Turkey believes it when the government says so-and-so and so-and-so happened at a terrorist attack. They know it's potentially lies. And we don't know what happened. I don't say I know what happened. What we need is independent police investigation. And that means genuinely independent, with one of the theories being that this is an inside job carried out by our own intelligence services.
One of the French journalists who does think that is Thierry Maison.
Indeed.
And his website, the Voltaire Network, there's been threats against this, against that by the Hollande government. Is there any credibility to what Maison is saying?
Is a very, very serious journalist, and he's got very good contacts inside the French intelligence services. And if people go to his Voltaire.net website, you will see his very serious allegations that the DGSE and other paramilitary formations linked to the DGSE, the French intelligence services, were the real perpetrators of that attack. And people say, oh no, surely not. I say, in Bologna railway station in 1980, killed 87 people, there was a bomb planted in there. The Italian police are absolutely sure, absolutely convinced that was carried out by NATO intelligence services. You don't hear about that on Radio 4, but you do hear about it on radio, Community Radio Bristol. This is the problem. There's a huge gap in people's understanding of how NATO intelligence services work. They've always been fomenters of terrorism. They've been fomenters of terrorism for decades.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you've got the Charlie Hebdo, all the talk about we must allow freedom of speech by Charlie Hebdo, but when it comes to the Voltaire Network, the French government see that as actually a threat to national security.
Indeed, indeed. And the reason why they're threatened by people telling the truth about how these operations are carried out is because it's actually, the whole thing is mind control, psychological warfare activity. And this is central to the way they're operating. What they do is they create they've created a series of Islamist terrorist groups all over the world, which they've basically covertly supported, armed and trained. And of course, we've got evidence for that going back to the 1980s now. Who disputes that the SAS and the Green Berets were training the Mujahideen and so on in Afghanistan and brought in an international Islamic International Brigade? It's in the history books. It was 20, 30 years ago. Nobody disputes it. They're still doing it now.
Another massive international story this week. Apple right to challenge an order to help the FBI? Well, Apple, what they're saying is this is an iPhone which is found, or at least connected to some of the people who we are told were behind the San Bernardino attacks, and Apple don't want to help the FBI to unlock this phone because they say actually if we create, and this is the small print in this story, if we create this program which helps you unlock our phones, we think it'll fall straight into the hands of organized crime.
Well, indeed, and of course, our contention is that the intelligence services who are supposedly investigating these attacks are organised criminals. I think the problem for Apple is if they don't want their product to be, and they don't want to be seen to be too close to the FBI, because who's going to buy iPhones if they think that they're corruptible and their stuff isn't going to be encrypted?
But there are a lot of questions about the San Bernardino attacks as well.
Indeed. We are now virtually all, I mean, we don't know everything about these attacks. We know much more about the attacks that happened in the past than the ones that have happened recently. The ones that have happened in the past, when Gladio started operating in Italy in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, to begin with, the civilian police force didn't know what was going on. Just bombs were going off, people were being assassinated, extremist groups of left and right were taking...
Some of them, of course, were actually killing police officers.
Indeed, one of the things that happened was the police were, Carabinieri were called to a suspicious car, which then blew up, killing the Carabinieri, and it was blamed by, said the Red Brigades had done it. It wasn't done by the Red Brigades, it was done by SISMI, the Italian secret service.
It's interesting that these false flag attacks haven't generally been happening in Italy, because I think the Italian media and the Italian public are very wise to these types of
killing. Well, that's what happens. They are happening in Turkey, but nobody believes the government's story about these attacks, certainly not the Kurds. And don't forget, we're not hearing it on our news every night. We were talking about Yemen. There's a full-scale war going on now in eastern Turkey between the Kurds, who've got their political wing, the HDP, and their military wing, the PKK, who are fighting tooth and nail against the Turks. And the Turks have basically shut Diyarbakir down, which is a city of 1 million people. Hundreds of people have been killed, civilians. It's as brutal as anything that's going on in Syria, but we don't hear anything about it. But, of course, there will be refugees from this heading our way. We are actually stirring the pot in all of these countries, creating more and more chaos and mayhem to pursue various nefarious geopolitical goals, and then we are trying to walk away and have a nice cup of tea.
Well,
it won't wash.
The big problem here is that we're looking at a kind of what some people, including Sybil Edmonds, has called Gladio 2, which is a kind of Operation Gladio, which took place in the 1970s and 1980s, mainly in Europe, was where NATO was actually blowing up civilians and then blaming it on leftist groups who were then supposedly
and also working
linked to
with
the Russians.
Rightist groups to do these
yeah,
activities,
getting fascists to do these attacks.
Yeah.
We're now looking at the possibility that migrants will be blamed for attacks happening across Europe and
possibly in Britain too. That is why they discovered a passport, a Syrian passport, of one of the suicide bombers who supposedly carried out the
interesting
attacks.
Isn't it that there's no attempt to stop the conflict.
Why would you drop a Syrian passport?
Attempt to stop the conflict in Yemen, is there? Because that's going to be the next wave of migrants, isn't it?
Well, yes, indeed. I mean,
refugees, rather.
Well, indeed, and also Turkey, which is even closer. What are we saying to Erdogan about this? Oh, well, we are basically stirring the pot and presuming that it's not going to come back and hit us in the face.
Anyway,
absolutely crazy.
One of the other things that's coming out of this, particularly through the investigations by people like Daniela Ganser from Switzerland and others into Operation Gladio, is that there may have been some kind of Gladio-style operations going on in Northern Ireland during the Northern Ireland conflict. And this is something that came up a couple of weeks ago, Prime Minister's questions over the agent, informer, someone called Steak Knife over in Northern Ireland. And Tom Elliott asked this of the Prime Minister a couple of weeks ago.
Tom Elliott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm wondering if the Prime Minister can comment on recent events in Northern Ireland regarding the investigations into Steak Knife, the alleged informer, and will he ensure that there are equal investigations into the likes of the Enniskillen bomb, the Teban bomb, and other major atrocities by terrorist organisations?
Well, I will look carefully at what he says. We have to make sure that we look at all of these things in a fair and reasonable way, and perhaps I can write to him about the issue.
Well, that's a bit of an evasive answer, isn't it? What's been happening on that front recently is I understand that the IRA have got hold of the post IRA have got hold of documentation from the then RUC, which showed that for example the Shankill bomb, which killed several civilians in Frizzle's fish bar, and the IRA lad who was carrying the bomb, that the guy who was in charge of the operation was actually a British agent, and in actual fact that he jarked the bomb, use the technical term, he'd fiddle with the bomb so that it went off prematurely while the guy was carrying it, killing him and a number of civilians, and also the UDA, who was the real target for the attack, who were supposed to be meeting above the fish shop. They were tipped off and weren't even there.
That's legitimate MI5 activity, to actually make sure that somebody is tweaking with a bomb.
No, so jarking the bomb.
It kills the person.
No,
but yes. That's exactly the sort of thing.
No, because the problem with that, Tony, is that it killed a load of innocent civilians he was standing next to. That's the problem with that. And in any case, it's illegal. And of course, the real suspicion here is that they were using their agents both in the Provisional IRA and the Loyalist paramilitaries to prolong the conflict in order to amass more power for themselves. And I think the policewoman Ombudswoman for Northern Ireland, Nuro Lone, was interviewed in the Panorama programme that was on a few months ago, and she's saying we're now getting evidence that the British Army were directly involved in hundreds of murders, that they were actually pulling the strings behind an awful lot of what went on. So we mentioned Enniskillen there earlier. What happened at Enniskillen was that the bomb went off prematurely, killing a load of people that wasn't intended for the bomb to kill, but made the IRA look bad. And that's because the IRA were infiltrated from top to bottom by British Army intelligence, as were the Loyalists. And I think that that's the reality, that intelligence services, both here and elsewhere, manipulate terrorism to achieve their various goals. And I think the evidence for that is overwhelming. Anybody who looks into it for any length of time, looks at the historical evidence relating to the past, will conclude that that's what's been going on. And that's why we have big questions in our mind when bombs go off in Paris, etc.
Another piece of information has come out just in the last week or so about the Birmingham pub bombings.
I was going to mention that. That's another one.
The Birmingham Six that went to jail completely. completely, you know, they were all innocent people for many years. That actually it was only the sorts of investigative TV programs that now no longer happen that got them out of jail, things like World in Action. That we're being told that they believe that the IRA, a mole in the IRA, may have tipped off the police about the 1974 Birmingham
Indeed.
Pub bombings, but they let them happen anyway.
They let them happen anyway, and also, of course, the other thing that's come out of this, this is the relatives who forced this onto the agenda, the other thing that's come out is that they ignore, that they knew they had a coded warning from the IRA, and they could have cleared the pubs, because the target for the attack was the tax office in the rotunda above the pub. So the point that is easy, why you plant bombs in pubs, because it's easy, you wander in, drop your bag and wander out. But then you phone in and say, clear the pub, there's a bomb in it. And then they clear the pub and then the bomb goes off. That, but of course, if the IRA team is infiltrated by British intelligence, they then allow the whole thing to go ahead and kill a lot of civilians, because that then discredits the IRA, etc., etc. And that's how these people think. That's the way they work.
Radio reports, I can remember on the day of the Shankill Road bomb, listening to, I think it was Five Live or whoever, it was somebody... Yeah. Listening to reports, what they were saying on the day was that everyone was saying, well, actually, the police were driving, when the police did give us a short warning, but they were actually asking civilians to move towards where the bomb
was. You're talking about the Omar bomb.
Oh, Omar, sorry.
Yes, not the Shankill Road bomb, yeah, the Omar bomb. Now, but the point is, all the detail is mind-numbing, but what you've got to understand is that the intelligence services infiltrate terrorist groups as a matter of course. They don't just infiltrate them. Some of them they actually set up from scratch, like Al-Qaeda, which was definitely set up from scratch by Western intelligence services working with the Pakistanis and the Saudis. And then the story is that Al-Qaeda, which we'd set up armed and trained, led by Osama bin Laden, who was a hero when he was fighting the Russians, he suddenly got a bee in his bonnet and set off to fight with us, and we couldn't stop him, and what can we do? Well, we armed, trained and set him up, and I would put it to people listening to this programme, at what point did the Western intelligence services lose control of the jihadi forces that they've created? And what the Russian general staff will tell you and the Iranian general staff is they've never lost control. They are pretty clear. We know that ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra Front are basically run by the Americans, the British, the Israelis and the Saudis. We know that. Our military chiefs know that. And of course, they're now becoming increasingly willing to tell the truth about what they know. And of course, they have their spies at the top. They have their ways of bugging phones. And they are able to back this up with hard fact. And I think increasingly, the opinions of Western public opinion is going to be given an education in how all this works by the Russian general staff. Because they're sick to the back teeth of having to deal with this kind of sneaky bullying tactics.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Meanwhile, Obama is to meet Raul Castro, the dissidents on a historic trip. And dissidents on a historic trip to Cuba, Martin. We hear from Washington and from Reuters that President Barack Obama is going to meet dissidents and President Raul Castro in Cuba next month. The White House said just yesterday, announcing a historic trip that will be another major step towards ending decades of animosity between the former Cold War foes. In the first visit by a US president to the Caribbean nation since 1928, Obama will meet entrepreneurs and people from different walks of life during the trip on March the 21st and 22nd. But he's unlikely to see Fidel, former president and revolutionary leaders, the US official said. White House hopes Obama's trip will help accelerate change on communist-run island and cement progress made under his watch.
Well, I mean, I must say, if I was the Cubans, I would be aware of the old adage, if you sup with the devil, take a very long spoon. What the American strategy seems to be in relation to Cuba is to get them, because they've had sanctions on them for years, which have actually, of course, made Cubans much poorer than they otherwise might have been. But they now, and they've said that Cubans are fairly desperate to get rid of those sanctions. But at that point, you're then in a position to start trying to run color revolutions inside Cuba. And they were setting up, using government funds, sort of Twitter revolts and such like to get the youth of Cuba.
Surely what's going on here is pretty simple. Obama wants to go out with a bang, doesn't he? And not a nasty one, an explosion. But he wants to go out saying, "Well, look, this is something I've managed to achieve: getting rid of the sanctions."
Well, all right. Listen, it's a matter for the Cuban government whether they meet with Obama or not.
They're going to.
It's not for me to second guess it. I would just be extremely cautious because, in actual fact, what you've got in the United States is a huge military industrial complex.
Look, they're not worried about the military-industrial complex. They're not worried about Obama because he's going. So what he's trying to do, surely, here is to seal some of the deals that he's done while he's been in power, and to really just to say, well, look, at least I've achieved this. Look, I know there's lots of things that I've done that aren't wonderful, aren't good. I'm trying to deal with this awful military-industrial complex, but here's something I have managed to achieve.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about sort of obituary for Obama, as it were, I think. He was better than any of the alternatives, but that's not saying much. When you have got a criminal elite which is prepared to carry out attacks like the 9/11 attack, for example. I mean, the Russian General Staff, General Ivashov, who used to head it up, is quite clear about what happened
there.
Well,
didn't it start with the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Well, of course, they've been doing this stuff for years. We mentioned COINTELPRO by the FBI in the 1960s and 1970s. That involved assassination, blackmail, and all sorts of other nefarious activities. We do not live in a free society. We have an extremely militarised society where the elite make their money from selling weaponry, and they're very keen to promote war as a means of making sure that their pension plans are intact, and the rest of us are simply the meat in the sandwich.
So who's going to be the Democratic nominee, do you think, at the end of the year? Is it going to be Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is an extremely tarnished candidate. She's been deeply implicated, for example, in the destruction in Libya.
But she might win, we hear, because she's got something called superdelegates on her side. What's this all about?
Well, that's because the internal rules...
Even if she doesn't win democratically...
The internal rules of the Democratic Party, ha-ha, in the United States, are not democratic. Wouldn't you? Who would have thought it? It's like George Orwell. It calls itself the Democratic Party, but it isn't actually democratic. Very few parties around the world are, because there's actually an
oligarchy. What are these superdelegates?
Well, superdelegates are essentially... Let's compare it in a British context. If in the Labour election campaign for Jeremy Corbyn last year, there had been a core of about 30% of the votes which were given to existing party stalwarts, MPs, councillors,
Privy councillors.
People who were reliable, to make sure that the ordinary members couldn't just foist somebody onto the leadership they didn't want. Now, in those circumstances, Corbyn would have been blocked by the superdelegates, who wouldn't have been elected by anybody, just the party machine. The superdelegates what the superdelegates probably represent, basically, is the donors to the party. They are there to make sure that the money the party's been given isn't put into the wrong hands. Because there's two sides to politics, isn't there? There's winning the elections, and then there's keeping the donors happy. Because you need the donors to win the elections. And the superdelegates are there as a means of trying to basically prevent an insurgent from becoming the nominee.
Well, one of the things Bernie Sanders came up with this week, and I heard this actually on the One Love Breakfast earlier this week, briefly, I think it was on the 8 o'clock bulletin, and then it disappeared off the other 9 and the 10 o'clock bulletins. But anyway, Bernie Sanders, he's saying that doctors and the pharmaceutical industry must answer for the nation's addiction crisis. This is in CBS News. Asked what he would do to make recovery services available for substance abusers and addicts, Bernie Sanders called it a terrible problem that must be viewed as a health issue, not a criminal one. After plugging universal health care, he said it's also important to address the causes of addiction. The other question we have to ask is, nobody I know knows the answer. Why is it? Why is it happening? One of the reasons I think doctors are prescribing opiates in a way they have to cut back a bit on. They're giving out a whole lot of pills. A friend of mine got a molar removed. He got 50 very strong painkilling drugs, and these drugs are rampant. I think if we got to talk to the pharmaceutical industry about what they're producing, doctors, what they're prescribing, have to make treatment available to people when they need it. What he's effectively saying here, I'm giving a lot of little quotes there, Martin, is that actually what we've created through the economic disaster is a whole load of disenfranchised people, and rather than actually re-enfranchising them again, in other words, giving people jobs, making sure that the people have got a decent home, decent lives, we're just dosing them up with pills.
Well, don't forget that those who are dosing...
And the pharmaceutical industry are making a fortune.
Don't forget the whole business... in the United States of America, health is a business. So the more pills you sell, the richer
here.
You are. And of course, it's not a business here for the NHS, but the pharmaceutical industry is constantly bombarding doctors and saying, hey, you need to get some of our new stuff.
And you've
stuff
seen this
to,
week,
to hand
just a minute, because just
your,
this week we've seen a massive drive towards meningitis vaccination, where on Points West just the other week we heard a kid who had nothing wrong with him at all has had a massive compensation payout after a long, long fight from the government because he was given a vaccine of some, I can't even remember what the vaccine was. Nothing wrong with him. Oh, it's swine flu, that's right. Mm. And he's now got sleep apnea. He keeps waking up and he can't even properly go to school anymore.
If you run healthcare as a business, just like we were talking about the property market earlier, those who sell health stuff will want to sell more of it, because that's what they're in business
for. Like vaccinations, for example.
Whereas if you have a health service which is based upon genuine clinical need, and doctors are free of the pressures of making business decisions, then they should be making their decisions entirely upon a clinical basis. That doesn't happen entirely in Britain, but it happens a lot more than it does in the United States. And of course, they spend a much higher proportion of their GDP on healthcare, and yet millions of people in the United States have no health cover whatsoever. They die in the streets without anybody helping them.
Anyway,
that's normal stuff.
We've also had this week quite an amazing little snippet of debate between Saunders. The reason why we're talking about this, of course, is because, you know, who wins in the US also affects the way things go here in Britain, not only the whole world. Of course, the US being such an important superpower, and of course, Britain being its unsinkable aircraft carrier, we have to keep an eye on what happens in US politics. And we've had this week a bit of a ding-dong between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders over Henry Kissinger.
In the last debate, I believe in her book, very good book, by the way, in her book and in this last debate, she talked about getting the approval or the support or the mentoring of Henry Kissinger. Now, I find it rather amazing, because I happen to believe that Henry Kissinger was one of the most destructive secretaries of state in the modern history of this country. I am proud to say that Henry Kissinger is not my friend. I will not take advice from Henry Kissinger. And in fact, Kissinger's actions in Cambodia, when the United States bombed that country, overthrew Prince Sihanouk, created the instability for Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge to come in, who then butchered some 3 million innocent people, one of the worst genocides in the history of the world. So count me in as somebody who will not be listening to Henry Kissinger.
Well, I know journalists have asked who you do listen to on foreign policy, and we have yet to know who that is.
Well, it ain't Henry Kissinger, that's
fine.
For sure.
That's fine. You know, I listen to a wide variety of voices that have expertise in various areas. I think it is fair to say, whatever the complaints that you want to make about him are, that with respect to China, one of the most challenging relationships we have, his opening up China and his ongoing relationships with the leaders of China is an incredibly useful relationship for the United States of America. So if we want to pick and choose, and I certainly do, people I listen to, people I don't listen to, people I listen to for certain areas, then I think we have to be fair and look at the entire world, because it's a big, complicated world out there.
It is.
And yes, people we may disagree with on a number of things may have some insight, may have some relationships that are important for the president to understand in order to best protect the United States.
It's just a very different, you know, historical perspective here. Kissinger was one of those people during the Vietnam era who talked about the domino theory. Not everybody remembers that. You do. I do. The domino theory. You know, if Vietnam goes, China, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's what he talked about. The great threat of China. And then after the war, this is the guy who, in fact, yes, you're right, he opened up relations with China and now pushed various type of trade agreements resulting in American workers losing their jobs as corporations moved to China, the terrible authoritarian communist dictatorship he warned us about. Now he's urging American companies to shut down and move to China. Not my kind of guy.
Senator.
That was Bernie Sanders there, Democratic nominee, contender for the Democratic nomination, debating on Henry Kissinger and China with Hillary Clinton, Martin.
Well, that's the first time that foreign policy has really impinged on the Democratic side of the debate in the US. And I think that, you know, Sanders' points about Kissinger are extremely pertinent. And, of course, relate to what we were talking about earlier, which is if people don't understand history, they don't understand the choices that they face. Kissinger is a war criminal. He's as much a war criminal, for example, as somebody like Slobodan Milosevic, without a doubt. Without a doubt. In a free society, in a rule of law society, he would have been put in prison and quite possibly, given existing US law, possibly executed. And you think you can't say things like that? I think I can say things like that. Criminals are criminals are criminals.
But bizarrely enough, Martin, just a minute, because he's made decisions in the US and he would be judged under US law. These things have happened abroad.
The things he did were illegal under US law when he did them. That's the point. And the idea that these people have got to be treated with kid gloves is absurd. Well, but I will make this point. Bernie Sanders, in fact, is quite weak on some foreign policy things from my point of view. And also, Kissinger is actually rather more rational about Russia and Syria than some of the people like Hillary Clinton. Maybe she should listen to Kissinger about Russia and Syria, because he's got more sense about it than she's got.
Also, we've had on the Republican side, Donald Trump this week upsetting the Pope. The Pope has then called him unchristian. He then got very upset about that. Is he any right, the Pope, to call Trump unchristian?
Well, the substantive disagreement between them was the attitude towards immigration into the US. And the Pope, being an Argentinian Catholic, tends to feel that, you know, you've got to see these people as human beings and deal with it as a human problem. Trump is making a big deal about saying we don't want these people around here.
See, the interesting thing is, I think it was 1054, wasn't it? The split between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
We've just had, literally, this week, the first meeting between the Russian Orthodox Patriarch, I think they call him, and the Pope. Amazing. Over in Cuba, I think it was.
Well, that's very good, isn't it? And that just shows how international politics can work.
And
presumably the Russian Orthodox people will be in Cuba because of the historic links between Cuba and Russia because of the Cold War. So again, a little chat behind the scenes helps to sort of everybody to sort of understand each other's position.
But I mean,
Pope Francis is, in Catholic terms, a progressive pope. He's far more progressive than Pope John Paul or Pope Benedict.
But is he right about Trump?
I think Trump saying that we've got to stop all Muslims coming into the US and we're going to stop all immigration. Of course people are worried about immigration. The idea that you can promise to stop it, well, first of all, you've got to stop destabilising the economies of Central America and North-South America. So you'd have to completely change your economic policy towards them, forgive their debts, allow them to build up their own industries without you trying to destroy them in the World Trade Organization. Don't make their poor farmers drive them off the land so that Monsanto can take it over. If you do all of that and try and stabilise the situation in Latin America, then maybe you wouldn't get so many refugees fleeing from what you've been doing. And that's just before we get to the drug dealing and the political destabilisation and the warfare, because a lot of people are running away from Central America because it's a war zone. Even now, it's still a war zone, because that what the United States has done to Central America over the last 50 years.
BCFM. Finally, Martin, we're going to have a listen now to Richard Tomlinson, who's the former MI6 officer, who gave a statement about the death of Princess Diana, saying that he'd seen the plans, effectively, which were used to kill her. I was quite fascinated to see the way that various people at MI6, that is two people, one is Sherard Cowper-Coles, and another is John Sawers, have both made it to the Bilderberg conferences over the last few years. And John Sawers from MI6 is also now on the steering committee of Bilderberg. Does tell us something about the closeness of the British Secret Services, MI6, MI5 as well, possibly, to the criminal elite.
Well, yes, it does, doesn't it? I think Sherlock Holmes, you can see a pattern here, can't you? How do you do it? How do you do it, Holmes?
Anyway, let's have a listen to Richard Tomlinson now.
Outside the film festival, Cannes is the moderately pleasant home to the Euro yuppie. It's also home to Richard Tomlinson, an ex-MI6 agent. We've had to come here to talk to him because he can't come to Britain or he'll be arrested.
This is with Mark Thomas.
The MI6 and the Foreign Office. Because the Foreign Office, they also work overseas trying to get deals for British firms, helping British firms find their feet in a foreign country, helping British firms make contacts. That's the job of the Foreign Office, Commercial Department. What MI6 does, they've got to do more or less the same job. What they can do, which the Foreign Office can't, is MI6 can pay bribes, and that's basically the difference. MI6 can go in and say, look, come on, we'll have a little meeting on the side, and if you tell us a little bit more than you told the Foreign Office, we'll give you a little bit of money. So that's basically what MI6 job is. It's basically part of the Foreign Office, which can pay bribes.
But I find this incredible, because Britain's just signed up to the OECD Convention on Bribery and Corruption. Yeah, we're supposed to be outlawing bribery and corruption, we're actually sanctioning it.
Yes, well, that's what MI6 exists by, bribing people. I mean, they phrase it around in a different word. They don't actually say it's bribing. They'll phrase it around in a completely different way, but payments to informers is what is their bread and butter. I mean, for example, a bank would have a huge advantage if they knew that Germany was going to move its interest rates next week, or it would give them a big advantage.
Well, you're actually responsible for blowing Okada. Which was the British MI6 mole within the Bundesbank. What was happening there?
What the MI6 officer's job there was to pay a German citizen, an allied country, to break the law of his own country. And so there you have an official from Britain in Germany taking taxpayers' money to pay bribes to a German official to break the German law. Whatever people might think about the European Union, we've signed up to it. We have to obey the laws of it, and it's totally illegal under European laws to do that.
Well, there we go. Illegality all over the place. They've got to be smashed and reconstructed as democratically accountable organisations.
Okay, well, it's time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 o'clock time. Up next, hopefully, is Mohammed Makawi's Arabian Night. Sorry, he wasn't here last week. I know he wasn't too well. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's leader of the Labour Group, councillor for Whitchurch Park on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Thanks also to Martin Summers there. Our sister show, Dialect, was dropped from BCFM, hopefully back in the next couple of weeks. This week, we look at £10 million of public money here in Bristol in a dodgy, secretive, so-called fund for the homeless. Also, speak to record-breaking Bristol explorer Belinda Kirk, explaining why we need more adventures. Thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show's links and our archives. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.